There are a lot of issues that come with just having all of your treasury sat in your own token. For example, if you sell 2% of your treasury, just 2%, you can experience up to an 80% price drop in
That
the
is very
value of
steep
your
drop.
treasury. It's insane. Yeah.
Very quick announcement before the episode. If you watch until the end, there'll be a special bonus for those who are interested in Phi Treasury and how to participate. So thank you for tuning in. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 21st episode of Colors of Web3 and Entrepreneurship. My name is Lum, your Web3 host today. And here I am today with Bo and Carlos. They are both from Phi Treasury, a Web3 startup. Can you guys give a quick introduction about yourself, Bo and Carlos? Maybe go in that order, Bo first and then Carlos.
Nice to meet you, Lum. Thanks so much for having us on. So just in terms of my background, you know, I've been investing in crypto since 2014, 15-ish. Was really when I first got my start. Ethereum, and I just kind of went down from there. But I've also been working in traditional finance for the last, call it 10 years or so. I was at JP Morgan for, you know, most of my career. Most recently, I was a portfolio manager there in their chief investment office. We traded $500 trillion around the world. I covered everything, right? And I was also doing a lot of their crypto research as well for the CIO team. So, you know, at a certain point, I decided all that was too boring and I wanted to dive into crypto rabbit hole. Full steam ahead. So quit that, came to London Business School where I met Carlos here, and then we started Phi, and you know, the rest is history.
Nice.
As far as me, a bit similar to Bo. I started my career in investment banking in California. Did that for a couple of years. On the side, it was also just kind of trading cryptos as well. I think is my first investment that I did with my first paycheck back in 20. And just being in San Francisco, had a lot of friends that were building trading bots or early iterations of different crypto companies. So grew some of those trading gains to do angel investments. Eventually, he was doing consulting on the side. In personal career, though, did investment banking for a couple of years, then was a portfolio manager at a bulge bracket bank doing alternative investments. Then even worked in venture capital doing fintech investments for a bit before coming to London Business School, where I got my master's in finance. Also helped start the LBS Blockchain Society there while I was at LBS, which is quite exciting. Became delegates for MakerDAO, Aave, and Arbitrum, and still very involved with that process. I was their first treasurer, and it's one of the reasons why we really started looking into this DAO treasure management intersection in particular. And that resulted in kind of building a FIDE, and here we are.
Nice. Wow, I see. Looks like both of you have a lot of very long career in finance, and I'm sure you guys know much more about finance than I do. Actually, I would like to deep dive a bit more about your background real quick. So can you maybe share with us from the timeline of like, since when did you first got to know Web3, you know, and then what did you study in college? Or feel free to share whatever timeline you think that shaped your professional career. Like, when did you decide that Web3 was going to be the thing? Maybe let's go with both of us.
Yeah, sounds good. I mean, back in uni, I dual majored in math and econ.
We have the same major, math and econ.
Oh, nice. Very yeah. Cool. Yeah. It's math and econ. For the parents that refuse to let their Asian kids do music, there's math and econ.
For me, I began with econ first, and then I put the math on top. But actually, the main reason for me is that I quit CS computer science halfway, so I was like, okay, I want to do math instead.
CS is hard. Like I never really wanted to go down that route just because my memory is just too bad for CS. And it's like, you have to learn like new languages and then build languages on top of other languages. And it's too much. But my background was in math and econ, and, you know, crypto is kind of a really good intersection of the two of them, right? In the sense that you have a lot of these, you know, standard economic principles, and then you use essentially like a lot of, well, not even that like complex math or at the beginning anyway, but in order to bring that in a way that is, you know, decentralized and can apply to pretty much all the users across the ecosystem. For me, like how I really got into it was actually one of our other co-founders, our CTO Andre. He and I were childhood friends growing up, and this kid's also like the smartest, I say kid, but like this guy's also like the smartest guy I know, right? He's like astrophysicist, PhD, like, you know, NASA type of super brainiac. And I remember back in 2014 or 2015, he texted me and was like, "Bo, let's go, grab a beer and let me tell you about the future of the internet." So he started
Wow.
shilling me about Ethereum, and then after that, just kind of dove into the Ethereum white paper, and a lot of it just clicked. It made sense at the time to me, anyway. Like, it was the answer to a lot of the issues, especially from an economic perspective that I was seeing around the world. And yeah, I started diving down that rabbit hole and never stopped.
Awesome. So you've already been with, is it like officially three cycles, I guess, right? In the
Yeah.
Ethereum, when like 20. Wow, that's very OG. Yeah. Awesome. So did you begin with did you get to know Ethereum before you know Bitcoin?
Actually, yeah, I guess
Oh,
my theme. The thing is, I always knew about or just all of it. But when I bought Bitcoin, it was mostly just for playing around on Silk Road and that sort of stuff. It wasn't
you actually
actually
bought
a
it on
big
Silk Road?
Yeah. It wasn't
Oh,
ever just
wow.
let me just hold on to it for monetary gains. I mean, I was also in high school at the time, right?
Okay.
But with Ethereum, it was slightly different.
I see. So you had more faith in Ethereum back then, right?
At the time, yes.
Wow. Cool. Yeah. Carlos, would like to know about your bit more about your background as well.
Yeah, I'm also similar kind of undergraduate background. I did economics and statistics over, so it's very close parallel to what you guys studied. I think, yeah, crypto always seemed like a calling, right? I think I was always interested in, I think anyone who studies economics, you dive into kind of monetary policy and all these incentives that get built by the Fed. My senior thesis was actually around the zero interest rate policy that was kind of occurring at the time. I mean, really diving into that, trying to understand it, what is the world going to look like and why is this even happening in the first place?
Is
I think
0% interest rate a good thing, a bad thing?
essentially was trying to incentivize people to spend money, right? To not save and to consume as a way to power the economy. And so it made it so that your utility was less useful if you just saved away money in like a regular interest rate. You had to take on more risk. So I think at the time I was like, wow, there's this like top down like pressure for people to just be spenders. So it seemed like it wasn't like a responsible thing to do. So I remember having a bit of a existential crisis at the time, being like, man, the future seems like it's going to be really kind of messed up here. And I remember the day I would always study in the campus library. And I think I was printing out some like homework paper or something. And there was a business card that said, Bitcoin money of the future, like buy it now type of deal. And there's sometimes in your life where you just feel like, okay, this
That's
is like,
awesome.
I felt like an energy to the card, right? It was just a business card, but it felt like an energy. I was like, wow. And then I think I put it in my pocket. It was like finals time. So when I got back home for summer, I started looking into it. And being an SF, right? Like Coinbase was already kind of barely getting started. So it was really easy to on-ramp and just buy cryptos.
What year was this? Was this like 2015 or something?
This is like 2013, 2014, like January 2014.
Wow.
So that's when we really started getting into it. And obviously, I think at that point, is right around the time it started really rallying as well and started getting a lot of kind of early attention. So it was kind of nice, right? It helped me pay off student loans like really, really fast. Helped me like just kind of catch up with savings and all these things. So that was awesome. In hindsight, I should have been like, man, this is it. Let me just get into it as soon as I can. But it's okay. I think I learned a lot in TradFi as well. I think what I learned in TradFi, obviously you learn about dealing with clients. You speak with a lot of institutional investors. I think you learn about how the financial system works and like the roles of pension funds and endowments, like them pulling like the strings from the background. I think one thing I learned as well is the inefficiencies of a lot of these big banks. I think I was always naturally interested in tech and kind of decent at it. So I was always put on these tech initiatives within the company. And oftentimes the banks would be just so big and slow that by the time they finished and were ready to implement, it was like outdated or just wasn't useful. And it kind of happened across the stack. There's a lot of very manual processes. And when you're on the outside looking in, you think, oh, it's all code based and it's very automated. And it's just a lot of layers of people around. So I think after a while, I really realized, okay, this is just not what I want my life to be, being like a middle in this like big, big machine. And there's definitely room for improvement here and ways to make it more accessible to people that, come from a variety of different income levels from, various places in the world. That's one of the things that drives me mostly in trying to get DeFi to work, is that we should be able to allow more people to access savings and investments in a very sustainable and safe way that really isn't available now, if you really think about the fees and all these things, the on-ramps. So yeah, so I think after that, I was always kind of in the periphery of crypto, doing it personally and just having friends that were very involved in it. Some of my best friends have been working in it for a very long time now. So yeah, that's kind of what drew me into crypto. And then once I met Bo and he was like, hey, I have a friend from NASA and we look into this thing. And we're like, that sounds very, very interesting. I remember actually the first time I met Bo, funny enough, like, because when I was really ready to like leave my job, I was like, all right, I want to do my own thing. I want to be my own boss. And I was actually, I had raised a couple million to start a real estate fund. And at the time we were going to be buying hotels out in nature because it was around COVID. So the thesis was that we were going to, you know, buy hotels in nature because hotels were distressed. It was probably a good opportunity. And it just didn't quite feel right. It seemed like I needed more experience and more network. So mentally, I was like, okay, man, I worked very hard for this, but let me put the idea of a fund aside for a bit. And I think like 2 days later, we had this chat with LBS that was virtual about our virtual careers. And Bo wasn't even on the panel, but by the end, everybody was asking him questions, clearly like the most knowledgeable person. And at the end, he was like, I came here because I want to start an investment fund in crypto. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. You know, I was just thinking about starting a fund. So I think the idea of that, of managing money, stopped for like 2 days until I met Bo. And then it kind of started up again in a different field. So I think some things, they're just meant to be, I suppose.
So this was when you guys was in London Business School?
This was even before that. We were, I think, already accepted and preparing to move. You know, they did virtual events beforehand just to kind of get people comfortable with each other and start giving you a taste of what the school is going to be like. And they had them have a blockchain one before they even had a blockchain club or anything like that. So it's actually quite surprising that they did that. And yeah, that's when I met a lot of the people that we started the society with, Bo and some of the other groups, other people that have gone to do startups and work at some of these larger layer one and layer two foundations. And the ecosystem has really grown there. So I think it's a good thing that we got involved. It's been a good network for us, for sure.
I see. So you guys basically work full-time on this after the London Business School? Is that fair to say?
During.
During. And then, yeah, which is perfect timing, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I think the idea was like, you know, there was no blockchain network at all at London Business School. So we thought, why not just kind of get it started as a way to kind of get involved with school, right? There's all these choices for clubs and ways to like get involved from like a personal perspective. We thought, man, let's just combine this and then let's do work and, you know, access
from,
social.
From what year with this?
This is like 2021. It's when we first started it. It's been a couple of years. We've done conferences. They're very active in governance. Every year, there's a few different groups and people that do startups. So it's been a really, really good group. Now that we're having more alumni, it's more transitioning. It's like, what is the alumni society going to do? And, you know, thinking about having like a DAO around like more of an alumni investment DAO. But that'll slowly get, you know, going slowly but surely. It's kind of a lifetime item that we just have at our disposal at this point.
Awesome. Yeah. So before we deep dive into the company, actually, I'm quite curious about your personal hobbies. Do you guys, if you share, what do you guys do for fun outside of Web3? Let's go with Bo and Carlos.
I've recently gotten into gaming.
Is it Web3 gaming or Web2?
Web2.
Okay.
It's not like Assassin's Creed. It's essentially like going through all the hits that like everyone's been playing for the last like 10, 15 years. And like I'm just now slowly getting caught up on. So yeah, just doing that. Checked out League of Legends as well. Couldn't really get into it. But yeah, so that. And then I do a lot of like music in my free time as well. Like, you know, singing, songwriting, production, that sort of stuff.
Bo's a really good singer, actually. Bo's a really good singer, guitarist.
That's awesome. What type of music do you write or sing?
Like sad, boring shit that people don't want to listen to. Like somewhere in between, like Lana Del Rey and Codaline.
I see.
You gotta say love songs for the ladies, you know?
Oh yeah, that's right. For the ladies. Love songs, yes.
There you go. Ballads, right?
Nice. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, cool. Yeah. What about you, Carlos?
Yeah. And, you know, I was really thinking this year, I've been so focused on work last couple of years that getting a hobby would be good. I think my life, I've always practiced martial arts, actually, since I was younger. I was always a very active kid. But then when I got a doll, I really got it. Most recently, Krav Maga was the one that I took very seriously. Nice. Yeah. I was also the treasurer of the Krav Maga Club at LBS.
Okay.
the Mixed Martial Arts Club. So just got involved to that. Seemed very practical. This year, I've been more of a kind of crypto nomad, I guess, kind of traveling around and living in different areas. So traveling has been a bit of a hobby these days, which has been really fun.
So you don't have a home right now, right? Or do you have a base home?
No. So and in awesome. Between bases, right now I'm in Italy, and I'll be going to eat Denver next week. And then kind of just traveling the world, I guess, going to meeting different crypto people around and trying to understand cultures from around the world, pick up new languages. So slowly but surely, I think that'll be more and more of a hobby until I settle down somewhere. Not sure where yet, but yeah. So that, tasting foods, I love coffee. A lot of things like collectibles, into whiskey as well, things like that. So yeah, just trying to live a rich life, I guess.
Yeah. I think being digital nomad is super fun. I have many friends in Web3, right? And they do a lot of these traveling around from one hacker house to, I don't know, hacker group or Web3 living, co-living type situation. Actually, it's quite fun. So that's something that...
Yeah, it's awesome. You meet so many cool people around that I think I would have never met previously, right? It's like, my base was London, but London is so cold, frankly, that I thought it'd be nicer to go somewhere sunnier. And so far, so good.
Okay, I see. Yeah, like Web3 co-living, I think it's quite fun. It's got to bring back to the new University College old days, right? Like if you ever live in the dome, it's kind of like that. But now with all the other adults and 20 people, I guess, or maybe many people sharing a big house or many apartments, something like that. I don't know the arrangement, but could be something fun. Anyway, so yeah, without further ado, let's go ahead and deep dive into your current company, Fight Jazzery. Feel free to share any presentation or deck or slide or website you guys have.
Yeah, I can share, do like a quick walkthrough of some slides. Let me know if you can see my screen.
Yes. Yeah. It's good to Great. Go.
Cool. I mean, so the whole idea, and then Carlos, feel free to jump in here at any point. Like the whole idea behind what we set out to do, right, is essentially solve a lot of the issues that you see in the crypto treasury space today. And not just treasury, but like, just the whole idea with concentration of assets, right? Most of the DAOs and protocols around have the majority of their treasury sat in their own native governance token. Now, that doesn't make sense, right? Like, even though that's kind of how it's done today, if you look at Uniswap, they got 100% of the treasury and Uni tokens, like that doesn't actually make any sense from a TradFi perspective. That's quite literally the equivalent of Netflix having 100% of its treasury in Netflix stock. Right. It's not exactly the smartest or the safest thing to do. And obviously there are a lot of issues that come along with that. Right. So if we scroll down, for example, there are a lot of issues that come with just having all of your treasury sat in your own token. For example, if you sell 2% of your treasury, just 2%, right?
Yeah.
You can experience up to an 80% price drop. In that the value steep of it's insane, yeah. But like, what most people don't realize, like, if you just mock up a 2% sell, right, out of Uniswap's treasury right now, just slippage alone, right, is something like 80%. So not only are they only getting 20 cents back on a dollar, they're literally wiping billions of dollars off of the value of the treasury because of the subsequent price impact. And you saw this happening a lot in the last bear market, where a lot of protocols and DAOs were essentially forced to sell because they essentially have to continue paying developers, audits, and that sort of stuff. And during that process, you experience all of these death spirals, right? And so every time a bear market comes around, so many good projects, no matter if, so many good projects just die out. And so if you want to promote the sustainability and the continued growth of the crypto ecosystem, we need to start from managing their treasuries and bringing some of the basic principles to make sure that these guys can survive across market cycles.
Interesting. By the way, do you think some of these, I'm quite curious because you mentioned earlier like Netflix stock, but you can give another example. How does Web2 companies manage their treasury? I imagine they put it in cash or what? What do they do?
Yeah, so in general, about 90% of that treasury is in cash. They usually have about 10% of it in risk assets, whether that's like, stocks or bonds or something like that. And then within the cash allocation, they try to do some sort of, you know, asset liability management where they use that cash to generate yield that they can then pay out to cover their operating expenses.
Okay, I see. And they probably take out loans, right? Obviously.
They can, absolutely, yeah. It's a lot cheaper to take, and it's a lot more efficient to take out a loan when your starting point is cash, which is 0% volatility, than, you know, if you're in the crypto space and your starting point is a token with 150% volatility, right? So it's a bit night and day there.
I think I'll also ask, I'll add that, like, Bo, you mentioned this all the time, right? In traditional finance, there's a wealth management industry, right? There is an investment management industry. So I think for, like, a lot of these corporations and enterprise clients, very rarely will they actually do the full stop investment in-house. Very rarely, maybe like a Chevron or something. But usually they always outsource it to like a BlackRock, to an investment manager. And then there's all these kind of middlemen groups that do a lot of the different like accounting, the, you know, the auditing, for example, the custody, for example, all this infrastructure that's already built up so that the kind of treasurers and CFOs of these corporations just have to look at kind of a spreadsheet, look at their kind of operating expenses. But for the most part, they have a lot of advisors and consultants. And that's not really something that exists in the DeFi crypto industry at all, right? The groups that are doing it, there's groups that potentially try to give advice, but there's still a very lack of infrastructure built in, right? Which is the slippage sale issue that Bo's mentioning, right? Where you have your biggest asset base not even usable to you know, for investment and diversification purposes or to gather yield, right? So you essentially have 99% of your asset base in locked capital. So I think that's the biggest shift that we're looking to bring here, where we're building the infrastructure to open up a new avenue of capital sources, but then also pairing it with the advice, the sophisticated advice that you would expect at some of the top investment institutions in the world, right? So I think joining those and making it DeFi native, DeFi friendly, it's a big difference of what we're trying to bring here versus what the world currently looks like.
Nice, I see. Yeah, so basically, I guess Web2 already have a solution to manage the treasury, right? And then you guys are doing something similar, but in Web3, is that correct?
To put it simply. Yeah, kind of, yeah. I mean, Web2 has, you know, they've got, like, from a treasury perspective, they are light years ahead of where we are in Web3, right? Our goal right now is to help close that gap just a little bit.
Yeah. I think the big difference between what we're doing and what Web2 does is allowing people the ability to keep their own keys and be non-custodial, right? In TradFi, obviously, everything is fully custodial. So we've actually been getting interest from larger kind of enterprise clients that we've had conversations with that have said that, you know, they got burned by FTX, for example, right? There is a desire to be in crypto, but now they realize the importance of a non-custodial holdings of their tokens. So they're not really trusting centralized exchanges like they used to. There are custodians out there that cater to these types of groups, but it ends up coming back to the same spot where you're paying a lot of fees. You're still trusting like a third-party entity. And the biggest thing that we do that we haven't talked about is that within our vault, we have a solution. We try to be very holistic. And I think one of the big selling points is that we enable people to continue using governance. We see that as a very major part of the treasury management's landscape, especially for these crypto DAOs and protocols. So a lot of these groups want to keep continuing the governance voting aspect of it. And no one really handles that currently in the way that we do. So there's definitely a few things where we have principles that come from, you know, traditional finance, like diversification, the risk management. Some of the trading strategies are very sophisticated, but obviously there's kind of on-chain things that happen when you're in a DeFi environment that just have to be very crypto native that we also kind of implement.
Yeah. On that note, I think it probably makes sense to actually just kind of dive into exactly what the protocol itself does, right? I've been teasing it for long enough. So essentially, you know, what we're doing is we're essentially hitting the various pillars that are important to treasury management and just good asset management in general in a single protocol, right? Like right now, if you want to achieve a lot of these things, you have to kind of piece together 4, 5, 6 different protocols. With us, you just get it all in one. And so what does that mean? So immediately, right, we help DAOs, protocols, founders, whales achieve broad market diversification using their own native token right off the bat, right? We can help them scale liquidity as well, right? When they deposit their native token into the vault, what happens is they get back a wrapper token for the vault. We're calling this wrapper token a treasury token. This token is pegged to the overall value of the vault. The vault goes up 5%, token goes up 5% as well. So there you go, broad diversification. But in terms of liquidity, what also happens is when you're actually in this vault, we allow people to swap the tokens within the vault. And that's actually how we maintain our, you know, concentration targets and stuff. And in essence, because you have all the tokens in the same vault already, when you allow these swaps to happen, it actually becomes one of the cheapest places in the entire crypto ecosystem to trade these token pairs at scale. All right. Like if you want to trade between Silo to, you know, TrueFi today, for example, you got to go from, or like Silo to Alchemix, you got to go from Silo to Rapdeath to Alchemix, right? It's a multi-step process. And of course, at each step of the way, there's slippage that you have to worry about, there's MEV that you have to worry about, right? With us, because all of the tokens are quite literally in the same vault already, you can bypass the whole process. You can quite literally just deposit in Silo and take out Alchemix, right? Like it's already there and prepackaged for you. So it actually allows people to, you know, increase the liquidity that they get in their for their own token. We generate yield in the vault as well that gets paid back out to the depositor. Not crazy amounts of yield, right? Not like 10-20% yield, but low and sustainable yield. And as Carlos mentioned, we allow for the redelegation of native governance rights.
So I think a question that I probably many people would have is that where does the yield come from?
Yeah. So there are a couple of things. So primarily right now, what we're actually using is liquid staking tokens, right? So like, you know, staked ETH, or wrapped staked ETH, actually like our ETH, right? Mm-hmm. And so a large portion of the vault is actually in ETH, just from natural accumulation of deposits that gets converted into these liquid stake tokens. And that essentially pays out the yield for a lot of the depositors. There are a couple of other things that we're experimenting with at the moment. I won't dive too much into it because, you know, they're still kind of in the works, but yeah, we're going to be opening up the sources to generate more yield in the coming months.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think yield is very, it's very good, right? And stable, yeah, because you keep coming.
Exactly, right? It's stable yield. We're not taking leverage, right? Like that's the most important part is that you don't want to overreach with treasury assets. Too often we see people try to like take on leverage or, you know, try to like juice up the yield. But like, look, your token is going to be up, right? 1,000%, 1,500% over the course of a bull run. Why are you trying to ape for that extra yield, the extra 20 or 30% yield, and put that 1,500% return at risk? Right? It makes absolutely zero sense. But, you know, people see the APY number and their eyes just get all excited and all that sort of stuff.
I think that's the big lesson here as well. It's like, and this applies to treasuries, also kind of beginner users or kind of from top to bottom, is that I think we're all in crypto because we see the potential, right? I think the potential to really change finance is definitely there, potentially things like social media, so many different use cases. So just being in the system for the long term should get you to a place where you'll be much better off in the future, right? But as we've seen over the last 2-3 years, hacks happen a lot. Protocols break because they're on crazy leverage, like Bo's mentioning. You get stuff like Celsius, Three Arrows Capital, FTX, right? So there's all these landmines that, like, if you stumble across those, you're kind of done. And now you're starting from point zero again, and then that becomes a lot more difficult, right? So even if you give up you know, a little bit of the upside because they're not taking on leverage or doing all these crazy strategies. Being in it for a long term and having the power of compounding consistently over time will get you to a much, much better spot. And that's kind of the main thesis here, where it's like anyone can kind of ape in and do quick returns very quickly. To sustain this for a long time and to be consistent, that's a lot harder. And that's kind of the mission that we're looking to bring here.
Exactly. And that's also why diversification is so important, right? Like, you don't want all your eggs in one basket. Like, name me one VC fund that has less than, you know, like five holdings, right? And like, if you think of crypto as, you know, super liquid VC plays, which frankly it is, right? You need to be spread out across a lot of different projects. You can't just have all your bag in one thing, because then you miss out on, you know, like, the various parts of the market outperforming, right? Metaverse outperformed DeFi by 20 or 30x in the last bull run, right? Most DeFi projects missed out on that entirely. And so, yeah, this goes back to the importance of making sure that you've got a little bit in everything.
Yeah.
I
think diversification is always a good choice in finance, right? I think that's like one of the first lesson that I learned in finance class, like 101. Diversification is good. Yeah,
it's literally 101, but yet at the same point in time, you know, there's a lot of folks in the crypto space who are vehemently against it. So it's, I think working on that education component of it is quite important. Carlos, you're on mute, by the way.
And this could dive into much more of the complicated technical stuff, but like, I've been thinking about a lot, like, why do people in crypto not believe in diversification? And, you know, it is partly because we don't come from a finance background, that they haven't dove into the math as much. But I think another key difference to highlight between us and our competitors, like a balancer, when you look at a balancer, they also have pools that have multiple assets. But because of the way they structure their constant function market maker, it actually increases the risk of their pool. Because they're essentially suffering from a lot of impermanent loss and toxic arbitrage flow. So that, for example, if one of the tokens goes to zero, the entire pool will go to zero as well within the balancer pool, right? So in that situation, in the current context of DeFi, diversification actually doesn't help you. But within us, the way we've structured our pool, it is more like what an index fund should look like, what an on-chain ETF should look like. So you can capture the gains of price drift and be able to rebalance into, you know, overperforming assets into other types of assets, right? So you probably will capture diversification benefits in the way that some of the leading groups haven't been able to do so far in the past. So,
A lot of this goes back to, you know, just fundamental, right, portfolio management principles. We can dive into this all day, but if you take an AMM, for example, right, and just explore what the performance of a liquidity pool from an actual, like, if you just look at it as an actual performance vehicle, right, and what it does, because that's why people put tokens into liquidity pools, right, to generate some sort of a performance. And you actually see what the performance is, it's really bad. And the reason for that, if you have like a multi-sided, call it 5 or 10-sided liquidity pool, the reason why performance is generally so bad, and we've like mocked this up, you know, we've run like Monte Carlo simulations to kind of examine the return distribution here. The reason why it's so bad is because you're always rebalancing to the most underweight token, right? Pretty much consistently. And so to put it into, you know, higher level context here, if you're a VC fund and you've got one project that is just perpetually underperforming, missing deadlines, there's a lot of turnover, right? They can't seem to get the shit straight. Are you just going to keep putting more money into that project?
Probably not.
No, right? Like, no, at a certain point, yeah, like, you would cut your losses, you'd put your money into, you know, some of the projects are doing well.
No.
Now, in a liquidity pool context, especially a multi-sided liquidity pool, that is exactly what you're doing. You're always just putting more and more money into the most underperforming token into the most underperforming project and bringing that back to par. So just mathematically, right? Like, I mean, you're just always going to underperform the broad market, right? If, you know, there's market drift and all that sort of stuff. So the idea of like just fundamental portfolio management principles is super important. And it's actually one of the, you know, main drivers of performance over time, right? But because I feel like, you know, a lot of that hasn't really been found in the crypto space so far, people tend to shun the idea of diversification a bit, right? Whether it's, you know, burned by various types of AAMMs or whatnot.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that totally makes sense. I think Carlos mentioned one point about like hacks, and do you guys do something to make sure that your protocol is safe, you know, and funds are SAFU?
Yeah, I think I think fundamentally another way to think about the services that we provide, I see them as like kind of three things, right? We have a very strict vetting process and a whitelisting process that Bo's been crafting to make sure that, you know, the right types of assets enter the pool, right? These are groups with vetted founders, with strong liquidity on chain, price oracles, things like that, right?
I see. So there probably wouldn't be any meme coins, right?
No, so there wouldn't be any stuff that like we wouldn't necessarily believe in, right? Sometimes meme coins have good companies behind them. They just, it's a marketing thing, right? So seeing within that veil is very important. And we run, you know, back tests. We do a lot of stuff with network analysis on that as well to understand the underlying concentration and how decentralized these projects are, right? So that off the bat, we really only want to allow the projects in that are, you know, aren't susceptible to like rug pulls or price manipulation, for example. Then once they're in the pool, we set up kind of risk allocations. We also call them concentration limits, right? This is where the diversification comes in, where we want to be able to have certain allocations to different tokens. We never want to be a 60% Aave pool, for example, right? Even though Aave is a great project, it just doesn't make sense to have that type of exposure to one token. So we have this constant monitoring process, right? Where if a token starts behaving oddly, it'll give us a flag, right? And we've partnered with a group called Hypernative that they scan for odd contracts that get created that usually occur when a hack gets initiated. Or we have internal tools as well to monitor when there's large movements or large mintings of different types of tokens, right? And then if we suspect that something is happening from like either like a price momentum perspective or from a flow of funds, or even just information that we get from our clients, we become in what kind of a central node where people reach out to us very early when they suspect something's happening. Then we have within our contracts itself, we've built in a quarantine process where we can segregate a problem token on its own to the side, and then have that be like in a place where it can be reviewed. It can be ejected at that point if needed, or it could be put back in if things revert back to normal, right? So this is something that's built within the actual smart contract itself, which also is a differentiator for us. So that's kind of trying to protect the value and the assets in the pool. Within the vault as well, right, we have a lot of these different checks. We've been audited by Holborn as well. We've had developers who participated in audit contests or have worked as kind of gas and security specialists at top firms such as Synthetix. So security is always definitely paramount, right? Another thing that we've also built in-house is just different simulation frameworks to stress test the performance of the protocol to make sure, like, if there is an edge case, how will the pool and the vault react when there's like a black swan scenario? And what can we do to build that in to the smart contracts themselves so they can be robust? And what do we need to do from an off-chain environment to protect ourselves, right? So that's another thing we're very excited about. So it's a very multifaceted approach to security and performance here that we've been building in.
Nice. It's quite a lot of things that you guys are toe ahead and building at the moment, right? Yeah. And
Dude, honestly, like at the end of the day, right, when you're dealing with treasury assets, you just need to make sure that everything is as safe and secure as possible. The last thing we want is to get hacked. We want for our clients to experience anything like that. So, we've done as much as we can to try to make sure that all this stuff is, safe for the long term.
Yeah,
Is
we
it
put our own
mainly?
money. Sorry, go ahead, Lem. Sorry, go
Oh,
ahead.
is it mainly non-custodial, right? For the customer, people who are depositing into it and your
That's right.
clients.
Totally non-custodial.
Okay. Awesome. Go ahead. Yeah, I think you want to share this slide. TRSY and FI.
Yeah, this is another thing that we were really. I was personally interested in this. It's like I want to use this personally, right? And put some of our own company, the money that we raised in this a bit as well, right? This essentially this pool will be for our own treasury as well. And we were very concerned about stress testing this thing. The timing of us building this company is actually very interesting because when we first started fundraising, and this is like still last bull market. People were like, "Oh, awesome team, awesome idea. You guys should raise more, have no problem, bigger valuation." And then Luna Terra crashed like 2 weeks later. And all of a sudden,
Oh,
people were like,
ouch.
there's like VCs that were like, "I lost a lot of money." And then we started and then continue the fundraising process. And then, FTX went down, Three Arrows, all these things. And so we were very hyper cognizant of like, we really need to stress test this tokenomics. So, like, if there is that type of situation, either on chain or off chain, we need to have a vault that is able to sustain that no matter what, to as close and a surety as possible. And what that ended up developing into was our simulation engine that we're calling it. And this is built by our CTO Andre, who was previously doing simulations at NASA, simulating like the formation of like suns and like black holes and all this crazy stuff, right? So probably one of the leaders in simulations. So that's essentially what we're using for our back tests, our portfolio management strategies, and to kind of hyper tune and optimize our vault here. It essentially takes real data, takes super sophisticated agents, and does all these computations, right, to find optimal arbitrage opportunities, find places where potentially things can break across different scenarios. At different points of time historically and in the live environment. And it'll be used for back testing, risk modeling, but then also things like just optimizing yield, for example. So it'll be super flexible, something we're really excited about that we've been working on the side in the background for like quite a while.
Is there some machine learning behind this? Artificial
So
intelligence.
not necessarily machine learning, because the thing with machine learning is you need a lot of data, right, to run a lot of computations. Machine learning is good when in TradFi when you have 10, 20 years of historical data. The problem with crypto that makes portfolio managing very difficult is that for even like Bitcoin or Ethereum have only been around, not that long, right? And even the getting data for that becomes very tricky. If you go back 10 years, a lot of the Bitcoin data is very spotty just because no one was tracking it, right? Much less some of these newer token projects, right? And
Yeah, they
typically
have to run a
within,
node to get the data.
yeah, and even
I don't
getting the
know.
node is very slow. Like we're using a Rust node, which is much faster than the traditional node, but blockchain is not built for historical analysis necessarily. And for traditional portfolio management, right, you want to create a matrix. And if your data points don't line up because you want to include a new token that's only been around for 6 months to a year, all of a sudden you start getting into really short data time horizons. So we've taken another approach using more kind of stochastic modeling, where in TradFi, right, you have to assume normality in the returns. There's a lot of assumptions that happen. But with stochastic analysis, all those assumptions don't have to be incorporated, right? It can be completely random. So it's more of an agent-based stochastic simulator. So we
Can
think it's a lot more flexible.
you give a like a simple definition of what's stochastic analysis here for maybe people who are not in the finance field, or maybe people who are not that good at math?
So it's a very interesting, it's newer to me as well, frankly. So essentially it incorporates the randomness of a lot of the probabilities that in traditional like backtesting and portfolio management, such as machine learning, aren't incorporated. Like in traditional finance, you need to assume some sort of normal probability distribution, right?
Yeah.
But for stochastic analysis, you don't need that assumption to be valid. You can have like a totally random price performance chart, and your modeling, it incorporates that directly into your analysis there, right? So we can model a lot of different scenarios. It's very good for black swans, where one of the questions could be like, what if the pool accidentally does accept a Lunaterra type of token, right? How can we account for this? And then we can kind of model that specifically to get an analysis, and then fine tune our smart contracts to the point where it's like, okay, the vault actually performs well, even in this scenario. Whereas in traditional backtesting, that becomes a lot trickier because you're more dependent on like a time series analysis, for example, right?
Hmm. Also, it's just really funny that traditional finance uses normal distributions when, you know, the data itself isn't normally distributed, but we can dive into this all day. Yeah, I'm not going to bore the audience with that.
That's true. That's a huge problem.
People watching this are probably like, I don't care about normal distributions.
That is so true. Is your code, like, technology open source, or is it just still private mainly? Most of it, I would say.
This part is still private. We're definitely wondering what we should enable. One of the key things we don't want to do is open this up and then you lose all this alpha or people use it to trade against the pool, right? Within some of the yield sources, we've been contemplating whether we can kind of give access to some of this modeling or use this as a service. Definitely use it eventually to help our clients with their tokenomics or to answer certain kind of edge case scenarios for them. Because then that kind of ends up being like due diligence for us and the tokens that we bring into the pool. But currently, this is kind of very, very private. You can get access to it by essentially investing into the pool. You essentially get benefit from the analysis that we create with it. But right now, it's only just us. And it's still a little bit in the earlier phases, to be totally honest. We have working prototypes, and there's things that are, you know, it's been a year that we've been working on this, but we still see that there's a lot left to be done as well.
When you say clients, is it mainly individual? Or is there some, some DAO treasury, other big
DAO treasuries, protocols, DAO protocols, yeah, crypto companies primarily.
Okay. So would you say they make up the majority of the deposit, or what is it called? Total value lock?
Right now, I would say a lot of the TVL is actually from retail. With our DAO clients and our protocol clients, we're working with a lot of folks who start with like a pilot program. And what that effectively means is, you know, 100K, 200K type of deposits. And then as the protocol continues to grow and as the bull market continues to rally and stuff, right, they can allocate more and more to it over time. But right now, because we're so new, we also don't feel comfortable asking clients to just eat the entire treasury into us. That's not good. Yeah. You know, if you want to put on your fiduciary, like advisor hat, you know, mindset, right, doing what's best in the interest of the clients, that's not what's in the best interest of the clients, especially when we're this young. So that's why we've been advising people to put in 0.5%, 1% of the treasury, and then scale up. But once we have a little bit of Lindy effect going, right, call it 3, 4, 5 months down the line, everything's been stress tested, nothing breaks, yada yada, come in with size. So that's how we've been working with clients right now.
That makes sense. Yeah, I think it also, I mean, diversification also apply for your clients as well, right? You could form from the perspective, they also want to diversify the treasury, right? They don't want to put like, I don't know, let's say 50% of the treasury in your protocol. I'm sure your protocol is great, but, you know, but they also have to manage their risk as well, right? Yeah.
So exactly. And after we've spoken to a lot of guys who got burned quite badly by Euler. And, you know, after that whole thing, folks are, I would say, a bit more cautious in terms of supplying liquidity as well across the space. And so starting with a lower, relatively lower amount, like 100 or like 200K, right, is easier for them to swallow, and it's much easier for them to move on.
Yeah, that's true. So how many people are actually working in your team right now? to build this product?
About 9 to 10 full time. Yeah.
Okay. And how many technical work in engineering?
Oh, was it 5, Carlos?
Pretty much everyone. So we have 4 co-founders, me, Bo, and our CFO, Baron, come from more of a finance background, right? Across investment banking, investment offices, private equity type of deal, even accounting. Pretty much everyone else is technical, right? Our CTO, Andre, was a kind of a research professor at Stanford and NGIT for a bit, used to work at NASA. Then we have developers that have PhDs from Cambridge, PhDs from UCLA, guys that have worked in tokenomics and simulations for like a long time. Yeah, so then everyone else is more kind of a lot more technical in the space, right? We're kind of growing. I guess there's 4 of us that work on the business side, marketing side, or 5 of us. I guess we're hiring every day.
No.
But then everyone else comes from a technical development background.
I see. And I think you guys said you raised some fund already back in, what is it, 2021 or 2022?
Yeah, 21 and 22. Yep, yep. We raised. Our round got led by OP Crypto. They're now called Inception. Super awesome guys that, you know, really believed in us. You know, our fundraising was kind of good and bad timing in that, you know, it was right 2021 when a lot of stuff was crashing and really kind of falling apart. So we were very fortunate to have an investor who was a very independent thinker and saw that there was a need for this and believed in us. And then, yeah, ever since then, we've kind of rounded up the cap table with a lot of awesome investors that have been really supported, really well connected in the space, and really helpful with introductions. So yeah, we've raised a couple million since then.
Awesome. You know, so before Web3, I work as a data scientist. So actually, I kind of love numbers. Can you share some interesting numbers or traction that from your protocol that you guys have received or have done so far?
Yeah, happy to. I think, you know, there are some cool things. Like we've had over 5,000 visitors to the site. We've had 700-800 individual depositors. You know, we're at 1.7 million TVL after having launched really like in January, the main protocol. So we'll take that. And I think the most, like one of the more impressive things as well is the performance of the vault itself, right? It's up 28-29% since inception, which was November 27th, 2023. And so if you compare that to a lot of the altcoins in the ecosystem, right, or even to other indices like DeFi Pulse and stuff like that, this has done so much better. And it just goes to show that the idea of diversification and capturing various levers of performance across the crypto space, it works. It pays off and it makes sense. And all of our clients who have been deposited into us, most of them anyway, have been much better off for it. And so performance has been good. Everyone's been happy. So fingers crossed this continues.
Awesome. So, I mean, with things going so well, what is there any challenges that you guys are facing at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think life as founders and people leading up the building of protocols, once you have a vault live, it's always very interesting, I think. We're lucky. I think we see a lot of opportunities for momentum and growth. And I think we also have a very flexible product where it could really be robust enough to take on a lot of different directions. So I think personally thinking about like, how do we decide what's the optimal path for growth? It's quite interesting to think about, right? Because we can pick so many different directions and we have gotten so much good reception. I don't think there's any like losing scenario that we can kind of go down. More about, you know, how do we keep up with the scale and momentum that we think we can achieve? And otherwise, just kind of building and delivering, right? We have some upgrades to our contract that I'm really excited about, right? Like we'll implement our swap feature here in a couple of weeks. That'll enable the kind of more seamless integrations. One, it'll be gas savings for depositors, more seamless swapping. And it'll connect us to kind of DeFi aggregators and just another source of yield, for example, different trading opportunities as well. And then leaning more heavily into integrations with things like EigenLayer and Liquid Restaking tokens more in the immediate term, right? I think is the path we're going to go down. But there's a lot of different avenues, a lot of different clients we're talking to. It's a lot of work to do for sure. It's kind of the challenge, I suppose. But
yeah. It's fun. Oh, I see.
Yeah, I've been telling the team as well, and just all of us collectively, is last year, especially towards the end of last year, everyone was working around the clock. There was a lot of, I don't want to say burnout, but, it's a startup, right? And you're rushing to get deadlines done and stuff. And so people were working hours that they should not have been working. My personal goal for this year and my hope for everyone on the team as well is to try to find a better line between that work-life balance. And even though it's a startup and things need to move at lightning pace, just being able to push back on that when you feel like you need to, is something that I'm personally hoping to do, and I hope that everyone on the team does as well.
Awesome. Yeah, I think work-life balance is very necessary to maintain the team spirit and so you can do the long run, right? Because I think running a startup is basically it's a marathon. It's not a sprint, right?
Yeah. You know what? It's a sprint and a marathon at the same time. It's a sprintathon.
Sprinting marathon. Oh, yeah. Sprinting marathon, it isn't. Yeah. Oh, shit.
I think thankfully everyone sees the interesting opportunity, and we've been able to get a lot of very smart people on board. You're always learning. A lot of people have left really good, opportunities and jobs elsewhere because they want to innovate, build something new, and I think we just have a really good company culture. So when that kind of happens, you don't really necessarily feel burnt out. I think at some point your body is just like, man, I need to do something else. But even when I take a short break, I'm always thinking like, man, I could be doing this at work, or I'm excited about this that we're building out, right? Or talking to this client or that client. So I think the spirits are very high. There's a lot of stuff in the background that is happening that we're really, really excited for. So this summer, will be awesome for us. I think we just see the opportunity and, just working hard to deliver it. So I think it's that pressure that makes it more of a challenge, but other than that, it's okay.
Awesome. Yeah. So I think that's an exciting part of running your own startup. So actually, I'm quite curious, where in the future, where do you think Web3 treasury management is heading? And then another question I have related is, can we use this solution for Web2 businesses somehow?
Identified, man. Come on.
Love that question.
But all seriousness though, I do think that there is a growing need, right? And a growing recognition for just a need for better treasury management, especially coming out of the last bear market. And now there are more and more products and solutions coming out that can offer that, right? The one thing that no one has really been able to solve yet, except for this solution that we're launching right here, is what to deal with that giant block of native governance tokens that just sat in the treasury, right? That's essentially like a dead asset, but at the same time carries the majority of the risk of your treasury. So, this I think is one of the first, if not the first solution to actually be able to give protocols and DAOs a way to put that to work. And I think moving forward, more and more focus will be and should be targeted on that specific part of crypto treasuries.
Are there similar solution or similar protocols like tackling this area of treasury management yet that you know of?
Yeah, I would say the term treasury management in crypto, it can be quite confusing because there's companies that call themselves treasury management, but it's like an accounting dashboard, for example. It's very complementary. It's like a partnerships that, things that we've done. I think the main competitor is Gauntlet and Era, because Gauntlet also does kind of similar risk modeling simulations as we do. And they also launched Era within a similar type of vault. I think the differences between our vault and their vault is that we wanted to really be decentralized and accessible for a wide range of people. Because initially we did have it in mind to be like, we're going to just cater to, institutional clients, right? DAO treasuries, protocol treasuries. But then as we spoke to the founders, right, their community and the people that were outside of the core group were so important, and we had to get their approval. So it doesn't make sense to just cater to to DAO treasuries and then, you know, disregard the rest of the community. So we decided to decentralize it, make it permissionless, which is a key difference between us that are doing sophisticated treasury management solutions. And then that kind of ties into keeping your governance rights and things like that. So
I would also say as well that, like, you know, in terms of ease of use, like, we are super streamlined. And for the average DAO founder or, you know, protocol founder, right, they don't want something that's quite complex that they have to structure themselves and set up themselves and go through that whole process of thinking about, you know, what's my objective function and all that, right? Like, if I'm a protocol or crypto founder with a technology background, that's not something that I would personally want to do. I mean, like, just even myself, right? Like, I don't know what my objective function would be if I were setting up a DAO or protocol. And so to that, like, in that respect, we wanted to create something that was just very simple that you can just deposit directly into and not have to worry about it, right? Let all that complicated stuff be done behind the scenes by a team that's, you know, had years and years and years of experience under the belt doing it. And the protocol and DAO founder can then just focus on doing what they're best at, right? Which is growing and building their core business.
Yeah, totally makes sense. And then the second question that I had was, can this be applied for Web2 businesses in the future? Is there any possibility in the far future, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, totally. We've been having conversations even from early on with very, very large kind of traditional businesses that, you know, we've been getting a lot of feedback that this would be also a very good way to on-ramp kind of crypto curious people that maybe don't even know the difference between Bitcoin or Ethereum or the importance of managing. Maybe they understand managing and holding your keys and being non-custodial now, but this will be a really good on-ramp for them, right? To get crypto exposure that they see is on-chain, where us as kind of the people representing the company can also speak their talk, right? We have the experience working in, you know, the Web2 field as well. So we kind of relate to some of the parameters and the company structures that they're dealing with. But yeah, we've been getting a lot of indication that enterprise clients, corporate clients, especially over time as they get more involved with crypto, want to be on chain. They want to hold on to their governance. And it's like, hey, this is exactly a vehicle that can cater to that. So we're definitely very excited about that possibility in the short term. We need to have a little more track record and be more seasoned. But I think that's definitely something that we can do. We have a whole full plan in place, and that roadmap's definitely in place to be able to scale to those type of clients. So that's definitely coming, I think.
Awesome. That's very exciting. Yeah. Just two more questions from my side. Actually, this one is like a sequel to the previous question. Is that what can we as Web3 builders do to help onboard maybe a billion people into Web3?
Man, smoother UI UX. That would be, I think, the most important thing, right? And just, you know, smoother wallet management systems. We held a Twitter Talks, I think last year, 2 years ago. No, this last year. And one of the speakers mentioned that it took on average 8 or 9 steps for a user to get into the DeFi ecosystem.
Yep, it does. Right?
Whether that's first you have to buy your token, then transfer it, and then, you know, sign your wallet and like all that sort of stuff. Way too many steps. So I think for a lot of this stuff, all this should be simplified. And that's one feedback that I'm actually hearing from my friends about why they don't get into crypto is they don't want to have to worry about private keys and people stealing them and hacking their stuff and then sending it to the wrong address and then losing it all on chain, right? Once all of this is solved, simplified, that's when I would expect mass adoption to really take off.
Makes sense. Yeah. Carlos, what's your take on that?
Yeah, that's definitely the biggest one, I think, as Web3 builders. Yeah, I mean, I think more consumer-facing apps as well, I think, would be interesting thing to kind of incorporate. DeFi, I think, is still very early, but it's a clear use case. So now it's like, what else is kind of crypto and blockchain going to be able to deliver? I think it has a lot of potential with things like AI, things like decentralized social media, for example. So kind of looking into that, right, making blockchain more personable and accessible. A lot of people that don't really care about finance necessarily, and then be like, okay, what else is it good for, right? So I think NFTs were like a hint at that potential, right? I think eventually things will come back. So yeah, I'm excited to see just kind of different opportunities that aren't just the traditional stuff that we've seen, right? There's such a blank slate still to be innovative here. So thinking outside the box, making it accessible for the regular everyday user, right? It's still a lot of builders building for builders, which still need it. There's still a lot of infrastructure that needs to get built, but the terminology needs to be simplified in order to bring on the people that, you know, want to be involved, but maybe don't necessarily want to be at the forefront, right? It still needs to be very accessible to everyone, to the world, right? How do we onboard grandmas and young kids on board, right? It's currently not there.
Agree. Yeah, agree. Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of challenges for Web3 UX, but more consumer facing app, I agree. Yeah, we probably need that. Do you guys have any advice for people who want to run their own Web3 companies or people who just want to start their own company?
Just do it. What's holding you back, right? Is it a team? Like, go on Token Engineering Commons and find a team. Our first developer joined us for equity. So, and that's the one thing that I hear a lot of people say is, I want to start a crypto protocol. I want to start a project, but I don't know where to start. I like the technical expertise, all that sort of stuff. Just troll the discourse, right? And just do it.
Yeah. I think that's the probably best advice. I think the other one is the importance of trust, even just starting a company, but then running it, right? Trusting your co-founders, trusting your investors, people trusting you, you trusting others. I think one of the best things you can do, people roll R, was like, you know, how do I fundraise or get investors, things like that, right? Mm. If you can get buy-in from one person that's done it before, that, you know, if it's a formal advisor or not, but someone who can kind of show you the ropes, make introductions, put their reputation on the line, and be like, hey, I trust this person. They're building something that I believe in, right? And they're willing to take that feedback and grow the company, or it's not going to be perfect day one. But if they could trust you, then that kind of opens the doors for investments. You'll bring in clients, you'll bring in employees, right? So I think that's the best thing. You have to be a trustworthy person in the day and be likable, right? And if you can do that, you can probably do whatever you want in this life and the world.
Yeah, yeah. I think those are the fundamental, yeah, for sure. Yeah, with that trust, you can really go the long, what do we call it, sprinting marathon? Can't really do that, yeah.
Sprint the thon.
Awesome. Yeah, so anyway, where can people follow you if I have a question? I know your website is, what is it, FYDE, F-Y-D-E, right? Yeah, that's your main website. But feel free to share any social handles here. You can spell it out. Right. Yeah.
Twitter is the big one, FIDE Treasury, at FIDE Treasury. And you'll see Ian Bo making posts on there. And join our Discord. That's where you'll get all the early alpha and opportunities to be an early power user, right? We definitely try to give early insights and opportunities to our kind of OG and early users that are on there, just to kind of reward our community. And that'll kind of keep happening in the future. But yeah. And then we'll be around different conferences. So please, people, reach out. We try to be very accessible, happy to chat, happy to meet in person for coffee or a drink or what have you.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, make sure to put the links and social handle down in the show notes so people can follow you and your protocol along. It's been a real pleasure talking about Web3 treasury management and, you know, how you guys are innovating. So it's been an awesome and fun conversation. Thank you for being on the show, Bo and Carlos.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Lam. Thank you for that.
Thank you. And we're back to my studio. Did you guys enjoy the 21st episode with Bo and Carlos from FIDE Treasury? So I hope you have learned something new about finance or Web3 treasury management. This is not financial advice, and full disclosure, I'm an investor in the project. So, but I leave a link to the app below along with the referral code in the description. We'll get more points if you deposit. And for the next episode, we'll be talking to Peter. He was the CEO and co-founder of Auxorio, a Web3 security auditing company. It's a very interesting space that a lot of people are following, so you don't want to miss. If you like, please give a like and subscribe. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.